Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Robert Klitgaard is a university professor at Claremont Graduate University, where he was also formerly president, formerly dean of the Frederick Pardee Rand Graduate School and a professor at Yale and Harvard. Professor Klitgaard advises governments around the world. His research interests include public policy, economic strategy, institutional reform, and corruption. He is also an accomplished author. His book, Tropical Gangsters, was included in the New York Times Book of the Century. His book, Choosing Elites, was featured in the Harvard Guide to Influential Books. Most recently, he released a book entitled Prevail, in which he addresses the big choices people are confronted with and how heroes can assist in these decisions. Thank you, Robert, for agreeing to participate in this podcast. Let me begin by addressing one issue in which you have made important contributions to enhance our collective understanding, and I refer to the question of corruption. Over the years, you have written extensively about its causes, its consequences, and what to do about it. Since it has been such an important part of your public policy work, I wanted to ask you whether, with the benefit of a long-term perspective, after all, you have been working in this area for several decades, you think that the problem is worse today than it was, say, 30 years ago. My own sense, for whatever it's worth, is that it is, reflecting, among other things, the continued expansion of the size of government and the opportunities that this provides for bribery, but also because we have seen the emergence of kleptocracies in many parts of the world, countries where the rulers seem to have complete impunity because they control the prosecutors, the courts, the police, and so on, leading to an increase in the scale and the pervasiveness of corruption. What do you think, Robert?
You know, Augusto, I don't know how to track corruption very well. When you ask people if their politicians are corrupt or if business people have too much influence in politics, you get numbers like 70% yes in the United States, 80% yes in Europe. And yet if you ask the same people, were you or someone in your family asked to pay a bribe this past year? It's 7% in the U.S. and 8% in Europe. So there's a big mismatch between people's experience and people's perceptions. And this matches, by the way, their mismatch between what they think of their local school district, very good, and what they think of the schooling system as a whole, not so good. Or how is their doctor in their hospital? Quite good. How's the health system as a whole? Not so good. Richard Fenno called this later became known as the Fenno paradox, where 95% of incumbents in the United States are reelected in Congress, and yet only 15% is the voters' confidence in Congress as a whole. So these perceptions of corruption that we hear all the time around the world are very difficult to track. But I agree with you that some of the trends are worrying. The size of government, it turns out, is negatively correlated with corruption in cross-section because rich countries have bigger governments. They like more public goods, and so the percentage of GDP that's in the public sector is usually higher in rich countries than in very poor countries. But I agree the rise of kleptocracies is a terrible trend and certainly contributes to the reality of corruption and abuse of power.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert. Share with our audience, because you know you have been working in this field for a long time. You have given much of your sort of early professional career to studying corruption. Give us a sense of what are some of the policies that have worked to reduce corruption, based on your own personal experiences advising governments. you know, just to give you an example, one of my favorite stories pertains to the introduction some 20 years ago of an online platform in Chile for public procurement. Chile Compra, as it was then called, forced all transactions involving the sale of a good or service to the government to be made explicit and transparently open, eliminating the opportunities for face-to-face interactions between a public official and a private seller. So here's an example where the use of a particular technology, you know, had a favorable impact in greatly reducing at least one source of corruption within this particular country, Chile. But I'm curious to hear you share with us perhaps other such experience that you may have had over the last many years.
Well, think about the Chile Compra example and why it's successful. It reduces the monopoly power that a particular official has over a decision about procurement, let's say. It clarifies discretion or limits discretion completely, and it enhances accountability. And so in structural terms, when you have a situation where there's monopoly power over a good or service by an individual, where there's a lot of discretion about how much you get or whether you get any at all, and where there's limited accountability in the sense of consequences for actions that are contrary to the public interest, in those situations, whether you're in California or in Chile or in Chad, you're going to have the structural temptations for corruption. And so systems that are able to reduce the monopoly, clarify the discretion, and enhance accountability tend to be less prone to systemic corruption. But more broadly, there are heartening success stories in the fight against corruption at the national level. One of my favorites is the Philippines in 2010 when Benigno Aquino III came into power. The remarkable changes that he and his government carried out led to the what the World Economic Forum called the most improved country in the world over his first 4 years in power in the Global Competitiveness Index, as well as economic growth, less poverty, and his own personal popularity compared to other presidents in the Philippines being month by month very impressive. So it's useful for us to focus on systems instead of deeper causes that seem to occupy popular discourse, and I have to say much academic discourse. What I mean by deeper causes are things like, well, you know, our culture is really corrupt, or we have this legacy of colonialism or Marxism, or it's world capitalism that's to blame, or even things as basic as greed, which people tend to blame for this situation. If we can get off those things and look at ways to constrain those histories and those propensities through structural reforms, I think we have a chance to reduce, although never eliminate, various forms of corruption.
Your reference to greed sort of leads me to my next question, which is perhaps a bit more philosophical in nature. You know, in many theological worldviews, sin is viewed as innate. And you could extrapolate this to explain the pervasive nature of corruption, to see it as a kind of an inevitable consequence of human nature or a manifestation of human nature, if you wish. And yet, at the same time, we know, and I think you will agree with this, that some societies have been more effective than others in reducing the incidence of corruption. So my question is a society without corruption an utopian and unrealistic ideal? Or do we have to wait 200 years until all the countries are rich and educated and prosperous, you know, like Sweden and Denmark and Norway, before we can claim victory in the battle to eliminate or drastically reduce corruption?
I think imagining a society without corruption is impossible, yes. And I'd like to make a comparison with crime, or perhaps better, with disease. You know, we've had disease throughout history. Every civilization has had it. It's written about in all the testaments we have and all the ancient histories we have. And so this might lead you to say, if not you, but might lead one to say, well, you know, we've always had this. It means we can't get rid of it, nothing to do about it. In which case you'd say, well, wait a second, look over time and across countries and you see the kinds of diseases, the severity of diseases, and the propensity or the prevalence of diseases varies radically. And so obviously public health measures, those are preventive, matter. Obviously, general nutrition matters, and obviously medical care, from pharmaceuticals to hospitals to doctors and nurses. All those things matter. The analogy with the fight against corruption is that there are preventive measures we can take through the structural reforms I described earlier, and there are, so to speak, medical analogies too, the kinds of surgery we have to take to cut off infected parts of our society, and the kinds of, quote, medical interventions that we can take, so to speak, to radically change the people in charge or their bank accounts. So I think that all those things lead me to conclude we can reduce corruption, but it's not in the cards to eliminate it, just like we're probably always going to have disease and crime in our societies.
Yes, I would probably agree with you, but presumably progress can be made, right, over time. Just to give you an example, we know that there is a great deal of discrimination against women. But at the World Bank, you know, a few years ago, we did a very interesting study in actually in my group. We looked for 100 countries at how discriminations embedded in the law, in the constitution, in the civil code, in family law, in the tax code, and so on, had evolved over a 50-year period between 1960 and 2010. So we actually, for these 100 countries, we went back to 1960 and we got copies of all these pieces of legislation, and we looked into the kinds of discriminations against women that were embedded in those pieces of legislation. And then we did the same for 2010. And two things came out of that study. First, great deal of progress. A lot of discriminations in places like Latin America and Africa eliminated from the books. So women in these parts of the world were better off in 2010 than they were in 1960. But in 2010 and 2021, to emphasize, there's still a huge gap. There is still a great deal of progress to be made. There is still too much discrimination against women. So you know, we have evolved in a way, and the condition of women today is better than it was 50 or 60 years ago, but we still have a long way to go. And my hope is that in the area of corruption, perhaps we can all aspire to have the relatively low levels of corruption of some of the high-income countries, especially the Nordics, which tend to do, as you know, very well on the Corruption Perceptions Index. But let me sort of shift gears a little bit. And you know, when I last heard you speak, you did not speak about the evils of corruption, but in a most interesting intellectual twist, I remember you arguing that when philosophers wrote about a full human life, they often forgot romantic love and intimacy. And more recently, you released a book entitled Prevail, where you discuss romance and intimacy and say that two common responses to upheaval are becoming a hermit and giving up or becoming an addict, seeking hedonistic pleasures. The middle ground, which you call prevail, involves someone who has values and make a difference. I find, I must say, this very appealing. And so you say in your book that the first step towards that this outlook is a calling or having a purpose. Can you please elaborate on these fascinating ideas and share with us the main thesis of your book?
Well, it's hard to summarize a book in a few words, but let me try it this way. You know, some of the earliest writers about corruption connected the word corrompere, to spoil, with the spoiling of a virgin, as well as the spoiling of a judge's neutrality. So there's something about sex and justice which the word corruption applies to both. The analogy here with sex and romance is that if you notice the world is full of sexual sin, let's suppose, as let's say the church fathers did, then you might say, well, what we have to do is avoid this altogether. Chastity is what's called for. Let's go off to our monasteries and bail on this sinful world. Not just sex, of course, but the corrupt world. It's too tempting. So Thomas a Kempis, the great Catholic writer in the 1400s, basically said, get away from all these material pleasures. They will seduce you away from your life in Christ. Now, another response when you're faced with the jarring realities of an imperfect and corrupt world and a sinful world is to just say, well, you know what? I can't fight it, so I'll join it. Let me go get as much sex as I can. Let me have as many romantic conquests as I can. And by analogy, this good materialism run rampant. If I have to cheat, that's fine. Let me do it. And in the limit, the argument is that, as with all addictions, the incremental value of additional conquests diminishes and eventually becomes a lonely process of the opposite of sexual intimacy in a real loving situation. And similarly, the very corrupt person loses track of what is valued and makes it hard to make calculations, as an addict does. So you might say, if we're facing an imperfect, corrupt world in many senses, what is the answer? And what I find is a pattern as an answer. The pattern is the heroic path that many people have written about in the past, Jung and others, which has the hero of religion and history, of myth and science, and of everyday life, characterized by four things. First, a sense of purpose, which often arrives to the person, is not something that she or he can seek out very readily. In other words, it's not a mechanical process. Second, a big insight that makes sense of the world and changes one's perspective about a lot of the facts of the way things are. Third, a feeling of gratitude for having received the calling and the insight, which makes one open to other people and humble about one's own attainments. And finally, this manifests itself in the desire to share that calling and insight through service to others in a compassionate way. And I think this fits into the romantic model because it means that you and I, with our spouses and loved ones, should seek ways to share our callings, to find big insights that we can share together, to feel grateful together and work on that, and then together find ways to share and serve in the small and in the large. So the heroes that I talk about in the book inspire us in two ways. One is their particular lives as examples can inspire us. There are many, many kinds of heroes, and it's not saying you should have a hero, but you should be open to the inspiration that they have when they face their challenges and upheavals, just as we do. And secondly, apart from that example, there's this structure, which then leads in the book to actually kind of steps we can take to work ourselves through the problem if we, for example, if we feel we've lost our calling, or if we're in the situation where we really haven't had one and we need to find one.
You know, your reference to service to others brings to memory a conversation I had a few years ago with a friend in Russia, in Moscow, somebody that I had met when I was there in the 1990s, representing the IMF. And with my wife, you know, we sort of have kept in touch with this person. And a few years ago, I was in Moscow on a business trip, and we got together for coffee just to catch up and find out how she was doing. And she said that she had had a near-death experience in India. She had gone on some kind of spiritual retreat, and she was run over by a bus and spent 6 weeks in coma in a hospital. And when she came out of the coma, she said that she had new insights about the purpose and the meaning of life. And so I asked her, well, what were those insights? Share them with me. I'm curious. And she said that the primary insight that she had was that was about the purpose of our existence, and that this purpose was realized to the extent that we as individuals bring blessings to the lives of other people around us, our friends, our family, our coworkers, those that we come into contact with. As we do, our life is fulfilled, and if we don't, it is not. As simple as that. And I think I find that very, very much in harmony with what you have just said. But Robert, how does this interesting new work sort of build on your sort of earlier intellectual interests and expertise advising governments? You know, people, our listeners, will be interested in how somebody like yourself, who has been, you know, working for many, many years, counseling governments on something as hard and as real as corruption, you know, makes a transition to be writing about values and purpose in life?
Well, that's another big question. Let me try it this way, Augusto. If you ask one of your friends who's not in the IMF or the World Bank, somebody you know in a rich country in Spain or in the United States, so what do you think about poverty, dictatorship, structural abuses in the so-called third world? And many of them will just bail. They said, you know, I don't even want to hear about poverty in India. I don't want to think about dictatorship in China. I don't even want to ponder what's going on in places in Africa. Or they may flail. If they're interested, they may back off from the real challenges and real choices that can save people's lives. Back off into armchair theorizing about the deeper causes. Well, you know, it's all their culture, it's their fault. Or it's colonialism, it's a legacy, or it's international capitalism, which must be blamed. And battling the problem at this level, flailing around with intellectual tools and deconstructions and regression models, seems to me to be a way of often of not making a difference. It could be a way to connect to practice, but too often it's an end in itself and leads to chasing one's intellectual tail. So I rather prefer, Augusto, people like you who have great intellectual power, have worked on creating data to describe how business can become facilitated around the world, working with governments, have written books about women's rights and so forth. But you're not afraid to go out in the real world and make it happen. And so that is, to me, the prevail path, Augusto. And you won't like this word, but it's a heroic path that you yourself have chosen, that we admire. So the second thing I'd like to say is about the process that's mentioned in this book. In my work in development, I've found that it's unhelpful for us, especially if we're not from that country, unhelpful for us to go in with recommendations. Much more helpful is to share our generic international knowledge and expertise, which is real, and evoke their local knowledge and creativity, which is also real, to engage with the problem in a newly productive way. So, for example, the doing business data that you created often helps countries locate themselves and realize they're not alone. Also, they're not just being accused of being ineffective or corrupt. So there's a way to talk about it with data. Secondly, the model I use has examples of success from other places. Once you've studied a context deeply, and if you have acquaintances inside your organization or if your own experience or your university who can find success stories which you can share with them in a kind of part A, part B, Harvard Business School method where they work through the problem and make their recommendations and see what happened and then discuss. And then third, after the data and the example of success is some kind of framework or model or checklist in the sense of Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto, which lays out some of the key steps. And then people work through that together systemically, thinking about the problem as a system. Now, those steps also apply to our individual decisions. We also, when we're stuck with a problem, we also need to locate our challenges and our upheavals and to see that we're not alone. If we're a homeless runaway girl, one of the best things we can see is to meet, with the help of other people, meet other girls in that situation. And we'll realize it's not just us. Secondly, a success story, meeting a person who's now 20 years old, who was a runaway girl, but is now in junior college or now has a fruitful job or who's now found a religion or something else, she can come in and talk to me in a way that no outsider can. And then third, some kind of framework which helps me locate the various strategies and various conditions I'm in. So I find that the same ideas hold the same process, if you will, involving expertise, but not expertise that dictates or instructs, but expertise that brings generic knowledge and helps people make their decisions in a better way. One final thing here, I use the analogy of a soil scientist rather than a social scientist in the sense of Max Weber or Marcel Mauss with his idea of le fait social total, the total social fact. Max Weber and Marcel Mauss, great as they were, thought we had to understand every feature of society to really get a handle about what to do. And the soil scientist, in contrast, says, you know, I've got a few things I can measure about your soil. I can talk about its phosphate or its nitrogen or its absorptive capacity. Would you like me to do that? It'll take me about a day. And then I can show you what we know from generic international knowledge about the kinds of crops that grow best in that soil that you have. Still your call. And by the way, if you still want to grow carrots, when I said they're not very good for that soil, I have another book which shows you how to treat the soil with fertilizer, irrigation, cross-cropping, shade, and so forth that make it more amenable. Now, the analogy for policy is I can help you choose the right policy for the setting you're in, or I can help you figure out how to change that setting so the policies you want will grow better. In my new book, Augusto, it's called The Culture and Development Manifesto from Oxford University Press in 2021, I describe this process using cultural information. And as you know from your work in international development, there's a bright line between the anthropologists and the people working in areas like economics and management. There just seems to be a cultural divide, if you will, right there. And I'm hoping that this technique of evoking local knowledge and also bringing in outside knowledge, you've provided a lot of examples in the book of how that can lead locals to make better decisions about their situation.
Thank you, Robert. Can you please repeat the name of the book again and the publisher?
Yes, it's called The Culture and Development Manifesto from Oxford University Press.
On your Twitter, you recently shared a video entitled Burnout and Backsliding. I guess coming out of the pandemic, many people are currently feeling burned out in their professional and personal lives, and this can lead to feelings of helplessness and a sense of loss of life's purpose. You suggest using positive cues as a strategy to combat burnout. Can you please elaborate a little bit these interesting ideas? I think they're very relevant, especially today as after 2 years of lockdown and you know, all the associated tests and difficulties of COVID-19.
Yes, burnout is an older term. It's been applied to the helping professions by Christina Maslach, the psychologist. And basically what relates to the book that I'm talking about, this is a chapter in the book, is basically a loss of that sense of calling, your purpose in being a nurse or being a teacher or being a fireman or whatever it is, frontline engagement. You just finally get numbed. You start treating those people that you're supposed to be loving and caring for indifferently and mechanically. And backsliding is an all too human thing where we commit ourselves. We've got a big insight. We've committed ourselves to a certain way of being, to join the gym, to be trivial, and then after a few months it kind of dissipates, or to change our lives in a big way. All those things seem to go back and back and back without some devices to hold ourselves. Now, sometimes the very devices we use become Pharisaical. What I mean by that is when Jesus condemns the Pharisees in Matthew 23, he says, "You've become like whitewashed tombs, beautiful from the outside, empty and full of bones on the inside. You declare the law," which is in a way, laws and regulations are a way to avoid backsliding. Don't do this, don't do this. You've elevated those to the answer, and therefore you've lost mercy and justice. So the purpose of why we do things, sometimes the very devices we use to keep ourselves in line, the rules, the disciplines, the strictures, can themselves get in the way of the original calling and insight. So what do we do about that? I find a useful technique is from game theory, from Tom Schelling's work on self-command, but also in the helping professions with the treatment of addicts. Now, addicts have a problem which has been modeled as a shift in the brain from one brain to another. In the morning, they get up and they say, okay, no more cocaine for me, and they're entirely sincere. In the evening, they go to the club, they hear the music, they smell the smoke, they see their friends, they see the lines on the table, and the economists have modeled this as a switch in the utility function. It's all boop, and suddenly they snort. The next morning, they're full of remorse. And so the question Schelling says is, could we model this as bargaining with ourselves, where we have to constrain our own choices? For example, we don't have alcohol around the house if we've been alcoholics. We don't have cigarette packs. We don't go to places where people are smoking. We make credible commitments and bets, which third parties enforce for how much weight we're going to lose or how many times we're going to go to the gym. And we have people helping us who are also trying to do the same things we're doing. And so the idea is maybe instead of avoiding the negative cues, which tool us up to our addiction, we can find positive cues that remind us of why we were doing what we were doing in the first place. Remember the times if we were creative people, remember the times we got started and fascinated by sculpture. go to those places and go to the museum and spend 2 days looking at sculptures. See if that can rekindle something. Or go to a weekend with people who now share the passion that we once shared. Or go back to the Rural Development Project where we first got our start and spend a couple of days there. It's these positive cues which we can try to bring into our lives often, which can inspire and renew our own sense of purpose and our own insights into why we're doing what we're doing.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Rob. Let me pose a last question, and perhaps a slightly unfair one. At the Global Governance Forum, our primary interest is thinking about the kinds of institutional innovations which might contribute to a better functioning global order. So in that spirit, corruption is clearly an area of interest for us. The governance architecture that came into being at the end of World War II with the creation of the United Nations is simply not working anymore. The UN Charter has remained frozen in time, and the world has changed dramatically since 1945. Indeed, when I think of the current tragedy taking place in the Ukraine, you know, that to me, again, is an example of institutional failure in our system of global governance. The end result of this, of course, is that we face a range of global problems, and we lack the institutions and the commitment to international cooperation that might help us find minimum solutions to such issues as climate change, poverty, widened income disparities, the reemergence of the arms race, and so on. This is a partial list. We could go on. Are you optimistic that we will somehow muddle through over the next decade or two and that solutions, let's say, on climate change will emerge and help us avoid the worst possible outcomes? What do you say to young people so that they do not lose hope in light of this paralysis that seems to have taken over, where we have these global problems like climate change, but we don't have workable solutions, and the problem is getting worse, and the predictions of the scientists for the next several years in the absence of action and cooperations are really quite dire and very, very worrying?
Well, your questions are fair. I'm afraid I don't have any particular wisdom to offer about them. Will it surprise you to hear a professor say, "I don't know"? Well, that's the way it is with me on these questions. I've never really studied them carefully, and I would hate to start blathering, as many professors do, about things they don't know much about. But I would hate to leave our interview in such a negative and downbeat note. So let's start with this. Corruption can be reduced, although never eliminated, just like crime and disease and poverty and pollution and prejudice against women and many other problems. Doing so, in my experience, requires both a systems approach, where we analyze the incentive structures, we analyze the information flows, we look at market structures and government structures, and it also requires impassioned leadership, which is sensitive to local realities, which means it must, in some sense, involve not only the politicians, but the private sector and civil society. That's a large order. I think I've given you a couple of examples of methods for doing that, but I wouldn't say the methods are foolproof or always successful, but basically they are involving ways to bring generic international knowledge into contact with local knowledge in a way that catalyzes answers that weren't there in anybody's heads beforehand. So given that, we might say, could we imagine such processes working on issues like climate change? Maybe what we need is fewer meetings like the 26th UN Climate Change Conference of the Parties in Glasgow last year, where, according to participants I talked to, said it was an endless parade of, first, descriptions of how grave the problem is, and second, ardent calls to action. Well, that doesn't really do much until we know what actions there are. until we have examples in other areas of global public goods where there has actually been some progress made that can inspire us here to think maybe we can do something like that, or at least ponder that, and also to get a framework for policies that go beyond a simple call for a carbon tax. There are many other things to look at, but people have ideological views about this which get in the way. So I think that there's some hope for the process we described earlier of bringing people together who are in a safe place, who can look at the data as they did at the COP26 about climate change, who can examine together data about the problem, can also study examples together of things that have worked in dealing with other global public goods, worked in the sense of made progress, practical things that can actually make a difference. And then finally, can study together frameworks for action, which include not just the preferred policy measure of the proponents and the advocates who tend to drive these processes, but also a wide range of other options, which may not be on the table right now.
Rob, I will give you the opportunity to conclude this very insightful, very thoughtful podcast to direct some words to a lot of the sort of young followers of the Global Governance Forum. You know, we have extensive following in social media. And the profile, while it is quite diverse from many different parts of the world and across all age groups, the profile tends to be on the young side, people in their, 20s and 30s. And talking to some of these people, one does get a sense that they are, maybe perturbed is too strong a word, but they're very sort of worried about the immediate future, our inability to address some of these global challenges. You mentioned COP26. I think that's a very good example, but it's not the only example. We have many other instances where we don't seem to be gearing up or putting in place the policies and the institutions that are going to help us address these problems in a meaningful way. And so there is sometimes a sense of loss, a sense of disappointment, a sense of foreboding, that we have lost our way, that the world is becoming somewhat ungovernable in many areas, right? And so if you have been a teacher for much of your life, you have interacted with students throughout your working career, what would be your parting message to these young people?
The best antidote to cynicism is success. When people start thinking, oh, there's nothing we can do about corruption, it's part of our DNA here in Brazil, or, it's all an illusion because it's all a concept that the West brought in, we're fine here in whatever country we're in. I think corruption is a great example of what you're talking about. Around the world, you find so much cynicism and despair about corruption. And so the biggest thing you can do to show somebody that this is not something they should just give up on, they should bail on, or they should just flail away with their concepts, is to show them an example of a place that has actually prevailed. By prevail, again, I don't mean eradication, but has made progress. And so if you're interested in education, you can look at the radical increases in literacy rates and tertiary enrollments. You can look at the effects of the internet on access to global information and science that was just unthinkable a generation ago. If you're interested in healthcare, you can look at the dramatic reduction in infant mortality. If you're looking at economic prosperity, you can look at the tremendous reductions in poverty around the world over the last 30 years, as well as the doubling of median income in the last 30 years. Around the world. Those things are all such powerful examples of things that work. And then we could say, well, what about the climate? What about these other things that haven't been solved? What about the war in Ukraine? What about the still overhanging nuclear situation? And I'd say, you're on, but let's not give up because it seems as if it's part of our inherently atomistic march toward oblivion that only can be solved by some international collective action. Until we show how that international collective action might work, as in the Law of the Sea conference, for example, how that actually worked to make a difference, or some of the disarmament treaties, I think some of these things would be wonderful examples to use to help people see that things can be done and to get them away from a tendency that is understandable but unproductive. So you can just lash out at the things that cause these problems, which are often these huge things, which I don't know what we can do about that. Human nature, colonial history, we can't do anything about that. Our cultural backgrounds, our DNA, we really can't do much about that. So if we can begin with examples of things that work, even on the hardest problems that were facing us a generation ago, including ones that are so ethically loaded and so politically fraught, like corruption, showing examples of things that work can inspire us then to move forward and try to prevail in our own lives. So I would tell them, you can do, you can find your exemplars. Find the people who have lives that you admire, who are doing good things. Find your heroes who are fighting the problems you care about, be they public health, be they education, be they the environment. Find them, study them, and look at how they found a way to make a difference despite a world that just seems crazy some of the time.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.